Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
We got the news. We've got Clint Black, country singing superstar Clint Black. That's all coming ahead. First, let's talk about LifeLock. 60% of Americans believe it's likely that identity theft will cause them a financial loss in the next year. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk on the internet. In an instant, cyber criminals could harm your finances and credit. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert and you'll have access to a dedicated restoration specialist. So protect yourself with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours yours with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year at LifeLock.com, promo code Adam. That's LifeLock.com, promo code Adam for 25% off.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral. Weird crime, protest, politics. Give me news with Gina Grad. Stuff they saw on TMZ. Joe Biden. Kamala. Meet news with Gina. Gina Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
Got some piping hot Jake Paul news. Defeated MMA world champion Ben Askren in a first round knockout that was scheduled as an 8-round cruiserweight fight on a Triller Fight Club pay-per-view. So here is the MMAfighting.com play-by-play. I'm going to read it to you. It's a total of 7 sentences, the entire play-by-play. So round one. Askren immediately advances, but Paul ties him up. He's keeping his hands high and his glove extended in Paul's face. Paul backs him up with a 1-2. Paul looking to work the body. He stings Askren, then goes back to the head. Huge right hand lands for Paul. Askren hits the mat hard, but looks to be on his way back up. The referee waves it off. The one is over. This one is over. And we have it. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I saw it. It's just a big overhand right. But Jake Paul's shooting jabs out there.
And it's interesting. You'll see the ref asks Ben to walk forward, and he kind of does, but then he drifts to the side. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that's when the ref said, we're done here. So here's like 30 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, he caught him clean. You know, you should hang out on the ground for 10 seconds and not get up in 3 seconds because you'll be able to get your... You know, your bearings back a little bit.
Jake's ready to keep tagging him. And now the ref, I don't know what he's wearing, but the ref says, come on over.
He's kind of lurch forward. I got to say this. A guy who has, you know, 21, 22 MMA fights under his belt, you let that guy go. Right. You know, if this is a celebrity fight and you got...
You step in.
Yeah, this ain't that. This is a guy. This guy's been fighting for years. You know what I mean? You can let... he's going to get knocked out, but you can let it go.
I was
going to
say, what do you think would have happened?
He's going to get knocked out, but he's going to take more punishment. Right. But guys, you kind of earn your right, you know, if you've done it for a long time to kind of go out on your shield, you know, when the guy asks you if you're okay and you nod and you walk toward them, even if it's gingerly, you got to let it go. I mean, you may not want to see it, but again, you're dealing with a really, I mean, not a, a seasoned wrestler and a seasoned MMA guy who said, I can go. So.
Do you think it's possible, here's my conspiracy theory, that somebody said to the ref, like, basically do what you did so Ben could be like, okay, I was happy to keep going, but the ref wouldn't let me. And that way it keeps the clout?
There's a kind of, you can tell when a guy doesn't want to fight sometimes, and they can kind of project that through their eyes and their sort of body language, and they don't protest too much when they wave it off. And also, you just got knocked out, so your electrical circuits are kind of firing everywhere. Right. You're not feeling your feet right. I mean, you're in a state. You know, it's like getting in a car accident or something, getting out of the car.
Getting punched to the ground.
Or getting punched to the ground. So it's a good clean knockout. It's always fun. I was watching the fight, and I was watching Ben, and Ben was kind of like doing that move where he holds his left hand out, like in front of him, sort of, and. If you're training somebody, you have to go no good fighter's ever done that,
right,
or it's never worked. It just that you're holding your hand in front of you, like it doesn't work. Like, okay, like you're a wrestler, mm-hmm. or your background is NCAA wrestling, or you have this experience, or you're a grappler, whatever. This is a boxing match. You can go watch all the film of Muhammad Ali and right. Joe Frazier and Marvin Hagler. You're never going to see them holding their jab out. You're not going to see it. So I don't know why we're doing this.
It's very Three Stooges when you put it that way. Like somebody's going to put their head up and try and hit them.
Kind of. And you're also kind of you're kind of signaling to the other guy that you're not really going to use that hand.
I was going
to
say you limited that as a weapon.
You did. Yeah, you do. It's sort of like seeing them take the hammer on a pistol and uncock it and like move it back. You know, it's kind of that. So anyway, I don't know what Ben has to retire after this. Like, I can't see any more MMA action for him.
But this wasn't MMA. I mean, did that help?
He's
him at
been
all?
Knocked out his last couple MMA fights. Yeah. It just didn't. He was in one league. He tried to go to the UFC. It didn't work out. Then he took this fight, and it's just
poor guy.
He didn't seem particularly in shape, which is a kind of a in shape for fighters, like dressing for a date.
No, you know, do it or not.
Dude shows up in flip flops. Like
it's a harbinger.
He ain't that into it.
Right,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you show up a little out of shape. Yeah. You're just not. It means you haven't been dedicating yourself for the last 2 months.
But I think I read that either way, he got $500,000. So he was in decent spirits in the locker room anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe he didn't care.
Right. Yeah. He's looking pretty dad body in this shot. Which, you know, you don't hold it against a guy at the park or the beach, but when you're going, it just means he hasn't been doing all the training that it would take to win a fight like this.
Is that a buffer? Is that Michael Buffer?
Yeah. There's two buffers.
There's two
Bruce
buffers.
And Michael.
There's Bruce and Michael. And it's kind of interesting that Michael has kind of overtaken Bruce.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of the whole UFC thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't the only fight this weekend. A high school girls' basketball game erupted in this violent brawl when an argument between one of the referees and a coach let this. It was a heated blowout. I'll show it to you in a minute.
So, definitely not a Jew.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to tell you how it started. So the official was caught on video throwing a punch at a spectator because he was like kind of getting in his face and filming him because you'll see. But like the ref and the coach are yelling at each other and they kind of won't let it go. There's a guy filming. The ref gets pissed, throws a punch. The ref gets body slammed to the ground, then attacked by one of the girls, one of the basketball players. So
I think women are fighting more than men at this particular juncture in our society.
Yeah.
I think if you go back to 1921, it was 96% of men throwing down and only 4% women. You've come a long way, baby.
Thank you. Yeah.
Because I think if you went back and just examined crime statistics of the last 2 years, I think women have finally, it's a milestone, but they have passed men for physical altercations.
Yeah. I think you might be right. Here's a play-by-play of the event. It's narrated by this guy on Twitter that goes by Young Mantis. It's pretty hilarious.
I hope he's enthusiastic and black if he's going to be narrating
this. He's neither.
Oh, man.
It's very funny.
Going out with the team, they are not very happy. Oh, we got a man here filming the referee. As I say these days, a video didn't happen. Well, we'll see it now. And, the ref swings.
He's in the whitey.
Here comes the daughter. Two-on-one fight. It's a no-holds-barred. Three-on-one. The son with the purse around his neck is going at the ref, too. And now Dad has a grip on the referee. And oh, my God, a swim!
John Cena. That was a big-time cartwheel.
Look at the girl.
Rounds on the dead zebra. Boys and girls, it's time for the running back turbo instant replay brought to you by Jimmy Johns. As you see, the referee is going to slap the father from the stands. And then the father hits the whitey with the righty. Take a look at how quickly the man in the neon switches his phone from his right hand to his left hand and hits the man with the right hook. And just when the referee thought he was
full of a second Paul type neon, shot man, right
the
there.
Body overhand slam right. By the neon man is just something you cannot find in any WrestleMania. But what really stole the show was when the 4-star crew threw not one, not two, not three, but 4 haymakers to the dead corpse. Well, we'll see you next week. Thank you to Jimmy Johns for being our sponsor, Freaky Fast Delivery.
Did he? Now, who was the girl?
She was one of the players.
No, I know she's one of the players, but did she have a connection to the guy
who
was out there filming? Because If it was just random chick jumping in, we should get her an ankle bracelet right now and fucking monitoring her because she's going to be fucking carjacking an Uber driver this weekend.
Right.
But if that was her dad.
Oh, you should be so lucky as a father.
I am going to mate her with the blonde chick who was getting in LeBron's grill.
Right.
At the Knicks game or whatever it is. I love that kind of the fucking vicious alliance. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah, you like this. You would expect Natalia to fight for your honor.
That was Natalia.
Yeah, right. I would. Okay. I would. So hopefully they were related in some way.
Yes. So in the wake of the fatal police shooting of Dante Wright during a traffic stop outside Minneapolis last week, city officials have approved a move toward unarmed traffic enforcers, according to Fox News. So Minneapolis City Council voted unanimously on Friday for the development of a new traffic safety division, which would be separate from the Minneapolis Police Department. The document listed four goals of this new enforcement division: maximizing the traffic safety benefits of traffic enforcement, eliminating racial disparities in traffic enforcement, educating the public on safe driving behaviors and traffic laws, and earning the trust of communities harmed by earlier practices. So they would not be armed. Mm. They would just come up to your car.
But they'd be police officers. They'd issue tickets.
They're not part of the police department. They're part of the traffic safety
division. Well, in as much as the, a meter maid is an officer.
I guess.
Right?
I'm going to file this under the homeless advocate, which is, this would be awesome if it worked. It's never going to fucking work.
Well, how terrified would you be as somebody going up to somebody's car, unarmed, going, hi, you're speeding?
There's been a lot of cases of people getting shot walking up to people's cars as well. You know, look, there's one thing that we can do immediately, which is you have to stop wrestling with cops. You cannot resist arrest. You just can't. That'll start all the other things, the training and the less than lethal, weapons and all that kind of stuff. That stuff is probably years down the road. That's a new academy class from the academy and new technology and all sorts of stuff. And I'm all for it. But if we could just literally just comply, all this shit would go down tenfold. And no one wants to talk about it because it's like it's not popular. But when you go all these stories, you have all these stories, motorists, this and that. Well, we tell the story where the guy's just, he's in the Wendy's drive-thru and he fell asleep in his car. And then they called the cops and the cops woke him up. And then he got out of the car and then he got shot in the back. Yeah, but you're skipping past the part where he wrestled both cops to the ground and grabbed one of their tasers. Like, that's ultimately what gets you shot. The getting shot by the cop willy-nilly, just like I'm obeying and I'm in the car and I got my hands on the steering wheel, that happens, but it's insanely rare, like statistically insanely rare.
Like that's when we mentioned Philando Castillo.
Yes, that was an example of a horrible cop shooting. There was kind of that other one where the guy, it was the female, and the guy got out of the car and went to go get back in the car. The problem is trying to get back in your car. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem with cops. They're beaked up with adrenaline. When you go back to get in your car, they just think worst case scenario.
Sure.
They think you have a shotgun in your car, you have a gun under the seat, or you're going to just plow through a farmer's market or something. Like you're going to, so comply. If you complied, I'm trying to think, like you have the, you have George Floyd, you have which we all got the tape with the knee on the neck, but there was another first half of that tape where he was wrestling with cops and didn't want to get in the car and he was out of his mind on drugs, and who knows what, if he could have complied, like I don't even know if he was capable, like mentally at that point for complying. But this kid who got shot, he was getting arrested, and then he broke free and he jumped back in the car, and then the adrenaline dump and the chick fucked up.
Yeah. It does make me wonder how long they've had tasers, because if she was, a 26-year veteran, how do you not remember what's where?
Yeah. Yeah, I would guess also if her plan was to execute black men, she wouldn't have waited 26 years.
Just before the long pension game. Kicked in.
And he probably waited till the trial was over or something. This was a bad time for her, if that in fact was her plan. That was this was bad planning from a career standpoint.
Well, and I thought about what Gary told us that Garrigus said about the Chauvin trial when He said basically it seemed like the defense felt like they had the upper hand, you know, as far as they've gone. And I thought
they were moving for something instead of a mistrial.
Yes. And then they said Chauvin's not testifying. So they must have thought, look, you can only screw this up. Like, we are in a good place. We're ahead of where we thought we'd be, whatever. If you stay quiet, we can stay winning. I would think that's probably a conversation they had.
Yeah. They didn't go for a mistrial, which there was an opening here for a mistrial. I guess Chauvin didn't do it. And they wrapped fairly quickly.
Right.
I can't remember what Garrigus' dad says, but the longer the defense takes, the worse it's going. Yeah.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how long they deliberate. I think they start today, as you hear this. And like we learned from OJ, well, I guess it was the opposite, but they said, like, if the jury comes back really fast, then it's usually a conviction. If they take forever, then it's usually not. So this will be very interesting.
I also was saying, do juries go, like, reach a conclusion and then hang out because they want you to think that they've given it some thought?
Yeah, that's possible.
And he's like, oh, yeah, absolutely. On one like this, you wouldn't just go and come back, especially if it was innocent or something like that. You couldn't do that. You might ask
to see some more evidence again.
And I said, this is like when I had to give the sperm sample that time. I rubbed that shit out in like 85 seconds, and I was like, you can't burst back out of this place.
Don't check your email.
Like, you can't. The chick who was in the reception, the nurse and the receptionist who was listening to Kevin and Bean, can't still be on the same commercial break when you come out with a tumbler of jizz.
Right, sure.
I have to wait till Offspring song starts up
That's right.
So I waited.
Good. Brian, I know you've also been through this.
Yeah, no, it took me forever.
Okay, I'm sure it did. All right. Well, let's talk about more restrictions and mandates coming out here. So,
well, that's its own kind of judgment, Brian.
I know.
You being trapped in there.
I was about to undergo cancer treatment.
Okay.
I spent an appropriate amount of time in there. In fact, I spent a little bit extra time because, remember, I did the thing where I put the DVD in, put it on pause, and then turn it all the way up and then turn the TV
on. For the next guy?
Yeah, so when they start turning the TV on, because there were DVDs of porn. And so I turned it up to like the most explicit point, put it on pause.
Yeah.
It's a TV-DVD combo, right? Like one of those old crappy things. Mm. And I turned the TV off, turned the volume all the way up, and let the next guy discover it. You know, flood the waiting room with the sound.
I walked in. They offered me that burnt offering. It was like a basket of porn, you know. It was
porn
a
basket.
Porn, but I travel. You know John Popper's harmonica vest?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had that with porn DVDs. So I was just able to pull a few out. Like, what do you like? Asian? Busty? What's your jam?
Right.
Yeah.
That's good.
I travel with it anyway.
I think it would all be up here in the old noggin.
The porn basket? Empty porn. Empty clamshells. They would have been stolen.
Oh, no.
Who steals? It was 2009. Who steals porn discs?
Yeah.
Do you have to choose right there in front of her which one you're taking
out of
the basket?
No, thankfully they locked me in a room.
Is this like a JetBlue flight?
Here's some materials. We'll leave you to your... I'm like, okay, thank you.
That has to be really embarrassing. If somebody was like... Get in there. Go to that room and masturbate. Come out when you're done.
That's pretty sweet.
It's got to be good for the nurse who works the station, like her stepson. Like, if she ever walks in and he's beating off and she's like, Tommy, what? Oh, you're offended?
Oh, yeah. Oh. He's delicate sensibilities.
I'm sorry, Your Highness. You work at a jizz shack. You work in a place where all guys do is beat off all fucking day.
You literally beg them for their sperm.
Judgment. Sorry you're not clocked in.
Yes.
That's good.
It's gotta be weird. You know how chicks can be sexually offended pretty easily.
Sexually offended?
What I mean is like you tell any guy in any workplace, any environment, any straight guy. You come in Monday morning, Gina's like, oh, I had a dream about you, Rick. It's like, yeah, well, what was he fucking hoping about? And it's like, oh, you put tile in my bathroom. Like, that's not what he wants.
Right,
you know?
Right.
If you say, oh, it's kind of sexy, you know, he's all ears. He's all in. He wants to know every fucking detail. He doesn't care if he's attracted to you.
Oh,
this is high praise.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You do that shit to a woman in the workplace, it's weird.
Oh, yeah.
They
get offended.
They get upset. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just saying, the nurse that works at the place where the guys are just 8 feet away rubbing it out all day. I'm saying she's a little different cut of cloth, you know. Her sensibilities are a little different, you know what I mean? Not easily offended. It's got to be guys like coming back, making nervous jokes stuff like that.
Here to make a deposit.
Yeah, right. They're saying dumb stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they're nervous.
I'd see that.
Saying that there's got to be guys who, when they offer the basket, they go, "Nah, I just took a snapshot of you, baby. That's what I did." Hey, you're gonna wear a nurse's outfit right before you ask me to beat
off. Look like that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that math
kind of
asking
done. For it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's so specific. It's not like you're a urologist or, you know, even a gynecologist. This is, you are the jizz nurse.
That's right. Oh, next Halloween. Write that down, Gina.
Okay.
It's a good outfit
Sexy
for you.
Sexy jizz nurse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got a wedding coming up.
That's true. So as states around the country lift COVID-19 restrictions, Oregon may go the other way. Yahoo News reports that a top official is considering indefinitely extending rules requiring masks and social distancing in all businesses in the whole state. The proposal would keep the rules in place until they are, quote, no longer necessary to address the effects of the pandemic in the workplace. But the idea has prompted a flood of angry responses. People do not like this. They're crying government overreach. And at least six states have lifted mask mandates. Some never had them. In Texas, business is completely reopened to 100% capacity.
Yeah, it's weird. It's an interesting thing to try to unring a bell. You know, so if you said, like, I walk around, I see people wearing masks outside, riding bikes, riding motorcycles, like it's a lot. And now, you know, there's no outdoor signs, but it's sort of like saying, you know, they said if you put this little stone in the pocket of your pants that you'll be protected from the gargoyles or something. And then at some point, and everyone does it, or most everyone does it, and then at some point, 8 months later, somebody comes out and goes, you don't have to have that stone in your pocket. There's no math or science. It says a gargoyle. So most people just leave it in their pocket.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what we're seeing. I went down to the car wash on Saturday, hot, sun shining, everyone just wearing a mask, just spread out, just that part where they're waiting for their car. Everyone's just sitting alone, just waiting for a mask. Like, I don't know why the part that always amuses me is like the one chick's got it pulled down to her chin because she's sipping off the Starbucks and it goes like right back up. She's sitting alone. Everyone is so socially distanced. They're sitting on those plastic chairs where you're waiting for the car.
Was it the one with the hand chairs on Cahuenga?
Yeah, on Ventura, Cahuenga, whatever.
Yes.
Like right there. Yeah. No, I like that one. But my tip is don't go stand by your car. Let the guy finish.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to bum rush those guys. But yeah, that's where we're at. I mean, I get it.
We touched on it. It's more social norm
now
than you know, people like, you know, than required.
I don't think people believe it anymore. I think people just don't want to be scoffed at.
I guess. I mean, I see people at the beach, people outside, people on the horse trail. I mean, yeah, I guess. Saw a guy riding a motorcycle with a mask on today.
What a friend.
Yeah, somebody sent me a tweet of a guy riding a motorcycle with no helmet and a mask on.
Which
Safety first.
An interesting relationship with danger there. But it kind of goes to show that the social pressure of the mask is, and more important than the helmet. It's kind of interesting. Here's an interesting thing. When we were traveling through Florida and we were in the car and Sonny'd had the blood to his legs cut off. I had to remove one of his... Like that movie, 27 Hours? Or what movie?
That's right.
Yeah, I had to pull a pocket knife out and remove his right from the knee down.
Sure, he's fine.
We're in the back of that car. And Sonny, who's never really experienced anything other than Los Angeles, is like, he saw guys riding motorcycles with no helmets. And he's like, hey, no helmet. Hey, no helmet. It was a big deal in his safety helmet first world. But so here's an interesting thing. A lot of guys in Florida, most all of them, no helmets.
Okay.
Now, I like freedom, and I've ridden motorcycles and race cars and stuff like that. I wouldn't ride a motorcycle without a helmet. I'm as fast and loose with safety as anybody. I've definitely put a helmet on before I got. So is it really all these guys that do not want to wear a helmet when they're riding, or are they virtue signaling the other direction?
Right. You can't tell me what
to
do.
That's a good point.
So,
yeah.
And there's a community.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Like, you want to have the two bikers pull up to your right and left, yeah. and you got your big helmet on, and yeah. they don't. They
hey,
got
safety
their,
Sally.
They got their bandanas
yeah,
going.
Right, right.
So I think it's a kind of a two-way street, pardon
right.
the pun, and I think minus any social group pressure, whatever, half those guys would wear a helmet.
Yeah.
And I think if you removed all the group pressure out of the mask would come off. But it's
right.
it's not just about safety.
Social
it's about
pressure.
It's the group.
Yeah, you can get it from anywhere.
Right.
That's a great point. Well, we were talking a little McConaughey talk earlier. Let's bring it back to McConaughey. TMZ reports that his chances of winning the Texas governorship are not bad. They could be legitimate, at least based on a random sampling of 1,000 or so registered voters who say they'd vote for him. So he stacked favorably against incumbent Governor Greg Abbott in terms of winnability. So according to a new poll conducted by the Dallas Morning News and the University of Texas Tyler, found McConaughey raked in 45% of the people who were asked. The team talked to over 1,100 people, registered Texas voters, slightly more Republican than Democrat, and when asked if they'd be more likely to support McConaughey over Abbott, nearly half of them said yeah.
Yeah, I think if anything, if we've learned any lesson in the last 20 minutes is that nobody cares anymore. I mean, about the experience or lack
yeah.
of
oh,
experience
yeah.
or there's anything. There, and it's a weird thing because you can go no experience and you don't like no experience, but then you can go too much experience, which is in the system.
Yes,
you're now
right.
you're now in. This is
right.
all you know.
Yep.
You know, I think you want the ran a business and ran a state or a city, like this little
yeah.
balance of I know what it's like to be in the private sector running a business. I also knew we have to deal with the legislator. Like I can
yeah.
deal with that. Like a kind of a balance.
Was Perot ahead of his time?
Probably.
He's a good candidate.
As a business,
yeah.
super successful businessman.
Because isn't that kind of why he was kind of, I mean, like laughed at in some ways.
He's like, I'm worth $3 billion.
Yeah.
I've done something right.
Right.
And also, when you take a look at the buffoons in politics now, you just realize this are really, yeah, there used to be a reverence. Like when I was a kid, it was like, that person must know something.
Yeah,
look at
scholarly.
Them.
Scholarly.
They're wearing a three-piece suit.
Right.
And tell me they don't
right.
know something. You know, now it's like, Twitter, what happened to politicians with all the news shows and all the back and the force and the Twitters and all Twitter wars and all the stuff, it's kind of the trajectory of Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro was a mystery his entire
sure.
first 40 years in Hollywood. It was like, is he smart? He's brilliant. Look at him. He's brilliant. Next thing you know, he's on The View and he's like,
right.
fuck that. Donald Trump that fuck himself in the fucking fuck stick. And you're like, oh, he's not that smart. Like, he's just that dude. Like,
right.
he we got a little peek behind the curtain. I feel like that's what's happened with politicians.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, like you said, it happens with actors because Jim Caviezel, in a movie you didn't see because it was too dusty, The Passion of the Christ.
Oh,
Jesus.
Yep. He made a guest appearance Friday at a right-wing convention called Clay Clark's Health and Freedom Conference. It was near Tulsa, Oklahoma, where organizers talked about COVID restrictions and what they consider the government's overreach and applying those rules. Now, Jim was plugging this movie where he portrays a guy named Tim Ballard, who I looked up on Wikipedia. He's the CEO of an organization that claims to free kids from like worldwide slavery and human trafficking. And it's part of something called like the Nazarene Fund. So I think it has, you know, religious underpinnings. Jim mentioned one of the real problems is the, and this is a quote, the adrenochroming of children. Mm-hmm. And when the host asked him to explain further what that is, he tried. This is what he said, and then I'll have a little more info for you.
A child knows he's going to die. His body will secrete this adrenaline, and they have a lot of terms that they use that he takes me through. But it's the worst horror I've ever seen, is screaming alone, even if I never, ever, ever, ever saw it. It's beyond, and these people that do it, there'll be no mercy for them.
What is he talking about?
So it was funny.
Is that a QAnon thing?
Yeah. And I have a little more info. But when he said – so, okay. Adrenochrome is a thing.
Yeah,
it's real. It's a compound formed by the oxidation of adrenaline. Its main medical use is to slow blood loss by promoting clots.
You can get high from it.
Yeah. Well, if you saw Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Although that's – you know, that was blown a little out of proportion. But it's adrenaline, essentially. Now, I looked it up, and here's what they say in conspiracy circles. It's a drug of the Hollywood elite. It's addictive. It's harvested from tortured children in satanic rituals. The current strain of theory is that a huge amount of celebrities have come down with COVID-19 due to a tainted batch of adrenochrome. Adrenochrome harvesting, according to the theorists, is done by drinking blood, heart surgery, or tapping into the brainstem. So what it sounds like Jim Caviezel was talking about was the exact plot of Monsters, Inc. Because if you have a kid in the house, you've watched it a lot, where you scare kids to power the community, and at the end they try to put that thing on her face. So what I think he is referring to is someone told him, and I guess it's Tim Ballard, though he's never saw it, that somebody gets a kid alone in a room and like scares the shit out of them and then kills them and harvests their adrenochrome.
Seems like the satanic ritual part of it seems like a time suck.
It sure does.
Robes and hoods and goats and stuff.
Like
if you're
forest.
Just doing the most efficient way possible, number
Go
one.
Go into a med spa.
If the Mexican cartels are not doing this, it doesn't exist. Because those people have found every conceivable way to make money off the misery of other human beings.
Very good point.
And they will diversify their portfolio in a hot second. If they haven't figured out a way to turn a buck off this, I don't believe it.
They dropped weed because it wasn't profitable. You have to find something else.
Going right to adrenochrome. That's right.
That's a really good point.
So is Jim Caviezel... never want to work again?
Is that what's going on?
Because it just seems like he's saying, I don't want to work anymore or only for Mel Gibson?
It was an odd way to promote this movie, if that's what he was doing.
So he cannot... Is he a deeply religious guy?
I don't know. I mean, is that his connection with Mel Gibson?
I'm going to base this off something I heard a long time ago. That's why he was Jesus in that movie.
Oh.
Like he was up for the role.
Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
All right, let's do one more, Gina Gray.
All right, let's see. Well, I know you love to collect stuff, Adam, and you might want to branch out. Cars are cute, but have you thought about the multiple statues of children from the Neverland Ranch?
Ooh, I could harvest their adrenal glands.
That's right. So several of the statues Michael Jackson had at the ranch are up for grabs, and Caitlin will show you a bunch of them while I read this. But it's a package deal. You can't just do a la carte. You got to take them all.
It's not a good story thing, though, because...
isn't it?
Well, when you display them in your living room and then people come in and they go, guess where I bought these? Neverland Ranch? Why? How'd you know? Who the fuck else is going to have these?
That's right.
You think I can head down to the fucking garden center and get this shit? Oh, or some other, you know, George Clooney sold me. No, this is the only place you could get
these
things.
That's a very good point. Well, there's 28 pieces, and it's the whole bulk of them will be sold for $2.5 million. And you'll get statues of mostly kids, including Kids and Tree Swing, Follow the Leader, Young Boy and Companion, Boy Playing Handbell, and the Footballer. $2.5 million, you get all 28.
Well... it takes all kinds, is what I want to say. It's an interesting thing that I love the aesthetic of architecture, and I love the aesthetic of a car, and I love the craftsmanship in many disciplines. But the little statues,
it's
kind of like, I don't know why. Yeah. I get it. It's also crazy how diverse we are in our likes.
Yeah.
Just put a song on and it'll divide the room. Yeah. Half the people love it, half the people hate it or whatever.
Dirty Dancing.
How about just politically country split exactly in half, like almost statistically, just in half?
Yeah.
How could you imagine that? Like, you know, like if you were picturing another world, you'd be like, well, half of the three quarters of the sneeches must be here. Or like, what are the policies? You just go with the smart stuff or whatever. Right. It's crazy. How many people I meet are like, I like ketchup on my hot dogs, and I like big tomato wheels as toppings on my pizza. I'm like, what?
Gross.
What's wrong
no.
with you? Who
Why
hurt
would you?
You
do that? It's like, well, I'm me. I'm here to confound you.
And all the, what's the story?
That's my belief.
That's why they're put on dessert.
I'm here to upset and confound you.
What's the store on Rodeo with all the very expensive tchotchkes? Not Fabergé. Yadro.
Yadro.
Those are very, very expensive, like Precious Moments tchotchkes. Like people love them.
Yeah, I don't.
Thank God I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, they're used. I kind of miss the Franklin Mint and all the Civil War figurines.
They meant the coins.
Limited edition
Franklin. They had plates. They had
plates.
Had everything.
Yep.
All right, let's bring her home, Gina Grad.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news. You are the Jizz Nurse.
Gina Grad.
That was the news with Gina Grad.
PaintYourLife.com. Want to give a truly meaningful gift. Now, this is no tchotchke. PaintYourLife.com. Professional hand-painted portraits created from any photo at a truly affordable price. You send them any picture you want, yourself, your children, your family, Paul Newman race car, whatever you got. And, how about like a special place or cherished pet?
Oh, yeah.
You can combine them into one painting. So you can take a few things and combine them. Anyway, you choose from your team of world-class artists and you'll work with them until every detail is perfect. User-friendly format and platform lets you order a custom hand-painted portrait in less than 5 minutes and you get it in about 3 weeks. And it's really cool. I did. I took a Paul Newman race car. I think it was 86 GT1 championship car. I gave him a photo and a beautiful painting came back. You pick the frame out. It's perfect for birthdays, anniversaries, as a wedding gift. It's paintyourlife.com, right, Dawson?
At paintyourlife.com, there's no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded, guaranteed. And right now is a limited time offer. Get 20% off your painting. That's right, 20% off and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word ADAM to 64,000. That's ADAM to 64,000. Text ADAM to 64,000. Paint your life. Celebrate the moments that matter most. Terms apply. Available at paintyourlife.com/terms. Again, text ADAM to 64,000.
Well, I talked to Clint Black. He's quite a gentleman. Got into his whole career starting off playing bars, demo tapes.
Clint Black.
He's great.
I still listen to Clint Black.
He's great, and he tells a wonderful, wonderful story about how it all began. So enjoy Clint Black right after this.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all-woke, no-joke culture. Has over 1,000 five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one.
Thank you, Adam Carolla, for being a voice and reason and get love the value in your podcast. I'm looking forward to reading the new book, plus I get to see Phil in the cover.
Thanks, Ozzy. Pick up I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now. Available in all formats. For more, go to adamcarolla.com.
All right, back with country music legend Clint Black. Clint's got a new TV series out called Talking in Circles, coming to Circle Network May 22nd. That'll be at 10 p.m. Eastern. Good to see you, Clint Black.
Good to see you, Adam Carolla.
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about, but one of the things I noticed on your bio is that you moved to Nashville. I was in Nashville yesterday, by the way, from Laurel Canyon, and I grew up on Laurel Canyon in North Hollywood. Laurel Canyon seems like a weird place for Clint Black to live.
Yep, it was kind of different. You know, I met my wife Lisa Hartman. She is an actress, so she was living there in Laurel Canyon on Laurel Pass, and so we kind of lived back and forth between there and Nashville. When we decided to have a baby, we moved over to Mulholland Estates, so we lived there for a long time. Behind the gates with all kinds of really interesting neighbors. And I enjoyed it. I really didn't know how to, if I had been left on my own there, I probably wouldn't have known how to enjoy Los Angeles. Same with New York. When I went to New York, I looked around and said, okay, let's do this press and get out of here, you know, because I had no idea what am I going to do here? You get in a car, you drive past a lot of big buildings, and you end up somewhere talking about yourself too much. And And that was it. But when Lisa and I met, and I went to New York with Lisa, she said, "Well, let's go out." And I said, "Where are we going? Where are we going to go? What are we going to do here?" She said, "Well, we'll just walk out of the hotel and start walking." Of course, that was absurd.
Yeah, where?
But that's what we did, and I learned that. You know, you walk out of the hotel, you start walking down the street, and you walk for blocks and blocks and pop in and out of stores, or grab something to eat, and when you get tired, you get in a cab and go back to the hotel.
And where did you grow up, Clint?
Houston. I was born in New Jersey, but my mom's Mobile, Alabama. My dad's from East Texas. And for some reason, she would go up. Her mom was in New Jersey for some reason. And so she would go up there for her last trimester of three out of the four kids. So I was back home back in Houston before I was a year old. But I really retained a lot of the accent. And people notice that's how they know I'm from New Jersey.
By the way, debut album Killin' Time had five consecutive number one singles, feat never accomplished in any music genre, over 20 million records sold, 22 number one singles. So I just wanted to brag on Clint for a second. So you dropped out of high school, you wanted to play music. I read you did construction for many years. What was it with you in school? Did you just know what you wanted to do? Were you a bad student? Yeah. Did people care that you dropped out of high school?
Yeah, it really wasn't about playing the music. It was I failed the ninth grade, so I repeated that. And then I made it through ninth and tenth, and then I was going to fail 10th grade, so I had to go to summer school. And that's where I first, at summer school, first encountered a teacher who made me interested in learning. And it was too late, though. I hadn't really been able to develop any study skills, note-taking. I was already kind of a lost cause for the school I was in, anyway. So I made it into the 11th grade, and I was going to fail again, and I was already 18, so dropped out, went to work in construction, and later in security, was playing bars. My parents cared, but not enough. They kind of saw the writing on the wall. It was obvious I was not going to achieve anything in school, but within a year, I realized what a terrible loss that was. And so from then on, I read primarily nonfiction. Read a lot of self-help books that might have helped, who knows. But I started trying to fill in the gaps, and spent a lot of time trying to make up for that. I don't know if I'd be a better student now, but I would have the will.
Did you have – I was a horrible student as well. Did you have – although I wasn't 18 and in the 11th grade. I wasn't that bad. But did you have a disability or just a lack of interest or not a family construct that sort of worked? You know, made sure you did your homework and studied all that stuff. What was missing back then? I mean, clearly you're an intelligent person, or were you bored?
I think I was kind of bored. I had bad sleep habits. My parents weren't really geared towards helping the kids with the school. You know, I tended to fall asleep in class. By the time I got into high school, you know, we were, gambling on the way to school, lagging quarters, and doing shakes where you take a hand, everybody contributes their coins, you shake them up, somebody calls odd or even. And so from time to time, I would end up with some extra cash, and I would buy a bunch of candy from the boosters and gobble it down before class. So I'd be all jacked up on sugar, which doesn't help in learning. And then I would crash and fall asleep on my typewriter in typing class, which I had 2 years of, and purposely failed because I was mad at my counselor for sticking me in that class. So it was just a myriad things that contributed to poor learning. But I can't blame the teachers. I think that really is all on me.
But you had the insight. I had the same sort of trajectory. I was a horrible student. I got out. I started doing construction. But I also had the same insight, which is it's going to be a long, dumb life filled with just walking around construction sites if you don't, you know, internalize a little, read a self-help book, try to figure out what went wrong, see if we can correct the course here a little bit. I mean, you were able to internalize. Like, you weren't blaming the teachers and you weren't blaming your family and the counselors. You were like, or even if you did blame the teachers and the counselors and whatever, they still weren't going to do anything for you. So you're still on that construction side alone. So maybe it's time to start trying to course correct. Did you have that feeling? Did you have that conscious thought, or did you just start gravitating toward a knowledge that you were trying to accumulate?
Yeah, I was an iron worker, and it was really brutal in Houston. You know, it'd be 124 heat index up on the pans, you know, and just really
the pans,
really hard work.
By the way,
pans were the forms. Yeah,
yeah, they call it Robinson decking, and they do the superstructure out of the I-beams, and they put the pans, and then they pour the floors in place, and that's why in a commercial building you have the cement floors going all the way up the building. So standing on that pan would be like standing on a cookie sheet when it's 100 degrees outside, but how much hotter it was on that pan.
Yeah, really hot. Plus, I'm working with pliers, so I'm tying wire all day, building columns and beams. And so, you know, my hands were just beat up at the end of the day. Lots of scars on my hands from getting cut, you know, by the wire. And just worn out. And every day I would ask myself, why am I not just singing in a bar? And finally, one day, my brother Kevin and I, we worked on the job where my brother Mark was the foreman. And one day we just dragged up and left and started playing bars and left poor Mark in a lurch. And but I never looked back. I just played bars. Kevin went back to construction at one point. But I kept playing the bars and trying to find a way into show business. I read all the Platinum Rainbow books and all of that. But it wasn't until I read a book about time management that things really started to change for me. And it's called Time Management, Work Smarter, Not Harder. And so that book taught me to lay out my goals. Short-term, medium-term, long-term, and under each goal, every activity I could think of that would help me reach that goal. So every day, I would be checking off some activity, and if I checked them all off, then I should reach that goal. And one of the biggest short-term goals was to get a demo made, and I finally managed to get that done, and that led me to a manager who had a track record, and off I went.
How old were you when you got that demo made?
27.
And when did music kick in for you? I mean, the knowing that you had an ability, a gift for it, was that something that was always around, but you didn't think you could make a living out of it, or did it kick in at some age? Were you playing the guitar in high school?
Yeah, I was playing guitar, harmonica first, and then guitar. And I guess at around 15, I started trying to write songs. At 17, I knew I had to decide I really wanted to be an astronaut, and so I decided either the Air Force or music, and I had to choose one. And of course, I had those singer's grades, so they wouldn't have let me into the Air Force in the first place. So I decided it would be music, and by then I was about 18. I decided even if I am resigned to a life in bars, I'm going to go for it. So at 18, I was basically I had a day job that I made no money at because it was on commissions. I was selling security services and consulting. I used to go around to apartment complex and hold meetings, and I would get the apartment manager to bring in, you know, everyone they could to come and listen to me talk, and I would talk to him about crime, the statistics, how things happened, most likely outcomes, and then of course I would have a little gadget I could sell them that would help them. But in doing that, I had to really learn all about crime, and I'd sold newspaper subscriptions door to door 6 days a week since I was 14. So I had dealt with rejection and getting the nerve up to stand in front of strangers and tell them things and try to hold their attention. But once I got into security, it was me in a three-piece suit standing in a apartment complex clubhouse full of people. Talking to them about crime and preventing things from happening to them. And so I did that for a while and starved at it, playing a little bit in bars. And one day my boss said, you really might ought to think about music full time. And I took that as a sign and hung up the suit.
How does it
just started playing bars?
How does one just start playing bars? Like, you have to audition?
Well, it helps. I had a friend who drank a lot all over town. And so he knew all of the bars. He knew all of the people managing the bars. And he would say, look, hire this kid and bring a group over when you have him here and we'll watch him. And that was going to be good for, who knows, thousands of dollars in liquor sales. So I got a few jobs that way. And then there was a guy who was really, really popular. I was a huge fan of. I'd been playing bars I didn't want to play. I was a soloist, and I was basically background music. People would be talking over whatever it was I was doing, and I didn't want to be there. I wanted to play in places where people went to hear the music. And I was in a music store, and this guy I was a big fan of, Shake Russell, walks into the music store, and I'm trying out guitars I can't afford. And I see him looking at guitars, and I start playing the intro to one of his songs. Mm. And he looks over and smiles and points. And I told him I was a big fan. And then I left him alone. And when he left the store, I went out and caught him in the parking lot and asked him, how does someone get to open for Shake Russell? And he gave me a card and said, call my tour manager. And I did. And within about a week or two, I was opening for Shake at places where people came to hear music. And Shake introduced me to all the clubs it made sense for me to be in. So I graduated to a better class of bars and did that for several more years. And those all led to different jobs. But that really was a kind of a step up.
How much of your act was covers and how much was original back then?
98% covers.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I was playing everything from Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson to Dire Straits. I think I did some David Bowie.
Really? Which David Bowie songs were you covering?
I think I did Major Tom. Space Oddity.
Sure.
Is the title. I may have done, just all kinds of different stuff. A lot of the singer-songwriter stuff, James Taylor and Buffett. But I would do the, Down to the Waterline, by Dire Straits, and just a few songs that lent themselves to that format. You know, just one guy and an acoustic guitar. A lot of Neil Young. I would play Billy Joel's Piano Man on guitar, which was really...
Wow.
Really just wrong. Just wrong.
Yeah, but I could see the crowd sort of getting a chuckle out of that.
I had the harmonica part down.
Yeah. Did people... Maybe it'd be tough to tell from your perspective, but did people understand that you had a gift for this, that there was something there, that there was a lot of potential there early on, or were you just a guy playing in the background?
You know, I was encouraged by the neighborhood first. So I would learn songs and go out into the neighborhood and play for people. I'd go out in front of the pool hall in my neighborhood and play, and people would throw coins in a hat. Once I started playing in the bars, I got some encouragement. There were people who became regulars and said, you know, you really have it. And, my family was very encouraging. I would say that buoyed me up quite a bit. But I just believed, I believed in myself. Had a really good vocal range, so I was able to, emulate a lot of really good singers like Kenny Loggins, and I also had some impressions. I did, I would do my Willie Nelson impression, Neil Young, Jim Croce, Dan Fogelberg. I could emulate them well when I wanted to, and kind of make some fun with it in the bars. There was one guy who was really successful as a soloist who used to just kind of jokingly call me Golden Voice. And this is someone who really had the whole Houston club market under his control. He was really, really good. And so that was a good sign, that he referred to me that way.
I'm always kind of curious when people are really successful, if they know they're going to be really successful when they're 24, 25, or if they just have a kind of a work ethic. Just read the book, motivate, use your time wisely, check that box every day, as you were saying. It's like checking the box. Would that be like play the guitar for an hour, check the box? Do vocal whatever for an hour, check the box? Was that the kind of look for an agent for an hour, check the box? Like, how did the check the box thing work?
Look for an agent for an hour. That's a good one. I wish I had that list. I wish I had that to look back on to see what all was on it. It would have been, a major goal would have been to find a manager. I was never trying to find the record deal. I was trying to find the manager because I feared trying to go into the game with just my knowledge. And I thought, if I can just find a manager who believes in me, they'll figure the rest of it out. Get a demo tape made, find a manager. On those, the activities for getting a demo tape made would have been, save every nickel I could. Look for recording studios that are affordable. The management thing, I would look at album liner notes and see who all their managers were. And when I got the demo, then it would be contact their offices, see who will let me send them a tape, mail them the tape, follow up in 2 weeks. Just kind of a salesman-like approach. And, I met a guitar player in a band. I needed a band for one gig. And if I had the band for this gig, it was at a great country club. And if I could just play this one gig with a band, he would give me all the solo gigs I could handle. And it was for about twice what I normally made. So I had to find a band. And I found this band. It had a guy playing guitar in it who was really, really good. And he and I hit it off. He had an 8-track recording machine. We made a deal for $150 a song. $300 if I got a deal out of it. Retroactively. So we started working on demos in his garage, and the first song we finished would be a single off my first album, a number one hit.
Wow.
And that was Nobody's Home. And I took that around to a publisher I knew in town and asked him if he could help me find a manager. Well, he wanted to buy the song for $250,
right,
which is exactly what I needed to not lose my car to the repo man. And I just hated that. I couldn't do it. I thought that song really could get me somewhere. So I found this record promoter I met when I sang in a bar. My parents entered me into a singing contest, and I was so mad at them until I won $500, and I wasn't mad.
So you never sold the song for $250?
I never sold it. I found this record promoter who had platinum records on his wall from all my favorite classic rock artists, and I told him the situation, and he loaned me $250 and took me to a manager who managed ZZ Top.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was at that point I thought, okay, this is my break. Funny story, when I got to Nashville, I met with two producers, and one of them was James Stroud, and I'm playing him this tape of four of my demo songs, and he tells his assistant to run grab this tape out of his drawer, and he brings it in there, and it's Nobody's Home. That publisher I didn't sell the song to had started shopping the song around Nashville, and it ended up in this producer's hands, who would go on to produce Killin' Time and many of my other records.
How many years before the first record came out is this?
You know, it was 1987 when I first came to Nashville and met with him. And the first record came out in February of 89.
So
it seemed like an eternity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're cutting a demo, I have no idea what the rules are. How many songs do they all need to be original? Is there one like killer James Taylor song you just honed in playing all those bars and honky tonks that you thought should be on there as well? Like, how does that process work?
I did just originals. You know, I think if you're not a writer, it can be cover songs just to show your wares. But I did originals only, except for the bars. If you're playing in bars, you need your cover songs. But I wanted to be an artist writer, so it was just originals. And I didn't know the rules either, but there were suggestions in some of the books. And I'd never made demos. So I'm working with Hayden, and now I'm learning – because he'd made a lot of demos, learning a lot from him very quickly, and they were good. They were good demos. They were largely the pre-production for the first album. A lot of what we did on the demos ended up, being the approach to the record.
When you start selling millions of records and you have so many songs go to number one, and now you're playing these huge venues. Was it a tough transition, or did you feel like you had so many reps, like you'd really earned your 10,000 hours, so to speak, playing so many bars for such a long period of time that you were able to walk out in these multi-thousand seat venues and feel at home, or was it a tough transition?
You know, I'd had the 10,000 hours of performing. And having those conversations we have in our mind, I know you have them when you're nervous, because if you're not nervous, you're not taking it seriously, right?
Right.
So there's some degree of butterflies depending on how routine it is. And so, you know, I was quite used to having the conversation in my mind that said, you can do this, you know the drill, once you get out there, you'll feel a lot better, relax, you want to be here. All those things you tell yourself that you need, you know, to build up your courage. So I'd had all that. What I wasn't prepared for is all of the other stress on the vocal cords. So I'm doing it at the beginning when it first took off, 9 cities, 1-night stands, 9 on, 1 off, 8 on, 1 off. There was one point where we did 23 straight cities without a day off. And during all that, I'm having to wake up at 8 a.m. and do phone interviews with radio stations and newspapers, go down to the radio stations and all of this other stuff, meeting, you know, dozens of people backstage before and after the show. And so, you know, at one point I called my manager. I said, listen, unless we want me to sound like Joe Cocker, you know, we've got to find a break in the action. I can't sing a better man. I can't sing these songs with these vocal cords. So that was really the eye opener. The success didn't bring the luxury of time and comfort. It just brought a lot more work and stress and challenge.
Well,
it did bring some money.
Yeah.
And I ran right out and bought the guitar I dreamed of having and could never afford.
You still have it today?
I still do, yeah. I bought 3 Martins, 2 D45s, which were always out of my reach, and 1 D40 BLE, which was a limited edition. They only made 50. And the guy I bought them from had, you know, when I was playing the bars, I couldn't afford full price on anything. And he would sell me guitar strings at cost. And when I finally couldn't afford but decided to buy a Martin D35, which was much cheaper, he sold it to me on time, even though he wasn't supposed to. And so he couldn't show it as sold. So I would get these phone calls at 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning after I, you know, just got home at 4 a.m. from playing a bar. And he'd say, you got to get down here and hang the guitar on the wall. So I would have to run down there and hang it on the wall because the rep was coming by, the Martin rep. And it had to be on the wall or he had to have the money for it.
And you just played it that night.
Yeah. So I did that for quite a while until I had that paid off at a huge discount. And then when I finally got my first check from RCA, I went in to buy these 3 guitars. And he, as he started ringing them up, he started to include that huge discount. And I get kind of choked up when I talk about it. Because it was a great sense of pride to tell him, no thanks. I'm paying full asking price this time. And it still gets me because, you know, that was a big moment for him and me because he was really in my corner all those years. And for me to be able to walk in and buy 3 top-of-the-line Martins with no discount was a big moment. And I'll never forget it.
An uplifting story to go out on. Clint Black, new TV series, Talking in Circles, is coming to Circle Network May 22nd, 10 p.m. Eastern. Clint, I feel like you should come back for part 2 because your life is so interesting and there's so much more to get to. Thanks for joining me here today.
Thank you. Thanks. I hope when we get to season 2 on Talking in Circles, I've got my network all teed up to let me have some comedians on. I hope you'll come and reciprocate and sit and talk in circles with me. And I'll promise to have some coffee that is just coffee because I know how you are.
I do love
coffee.
It. Yes.
I have a Clint Black Cowboy Coffee.
Oh.
Just came out with. It's ClintBlackCoffee.com. This is really great coffee, according to me, and the best and smoothest dark roast you will ever have. Made in Texas.
I shall partake, and I'd be honored to come on Talking in Circles with Clint Black. Clint, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thanks,
All
Adam.
Right. last but not least, I got Geico. Do you own, do you rent your home? Well, I bet you do, and I bet you work hard. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because we already have so much to do around the house. So get to geico.com. Get your bundle going at Geico. Go to geico.com and bundle. All right. Appleton, Wisconsin, Skyline Comedy Club, May 7th and 8th. We'll do stand-up there. We'll do live pod there in Los Angeles. We're doing Jam in the Van again.
Yeah,
doing
live pod there. Time.
Oh, okay. That'll be May 22nd. Go to amcarolla.com for all the live shows. Until next time, Sam Carolla for Paul Bryan, Gina Grad, and Clint Black saying mahala.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Check out Gina Grad and Teresa Strasser on the podcast Easy Listening, and Paul Bryan on the Film Vault. And a bunch of us guys here on a show called The Water Cooler. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And pick up one or all of Adam's books, movies, or tickets to a show. It's all there at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.